Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
So welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I'm joined by Mary Evans, who is Emeritus Professor of the Department of Gender Studies, and Hazel Johnson, who is the Department Manager, Department of Gender Studies, both at the LSE, and Sarah Moore, who's Senior Lecturer in the Department of Social and Policy Sciences at the University of Bath. And we're going to be talking about their new book, Detecting the Social Order and Disorder in Post-1970s Detective Fiction. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
No, and it's great to have all three of you. Usually, I'm only lucky enough to get one author. So it'll be really interesting to hear your three perspectives on the book. And actually, since I've got all three of you together, it'd be interesting to hear a little bit about where the book came from in terms of your collaboration. Mm. Like, have you always been sort of working together in this way? Or
we haven't been working on this same theme together, but Hazel and I have worked together for a very long time. Sarah and I have talked together in various ways, I suppose, for an equally long time. Mm. And so we just happened to come together because we all went public with an absolute delight in reading detective fiction. And then we thought, OK, let's do something with that.
Mm. Yes, and I think, yeah, I mean, what Mary's said is absolutely right, of course, but it's been a very slow-burning project, but in a really nice, good way, and I think that's been to the benefit of books. So I certainly started meeting Mary about 7 years ago to talk about detective fiction that we love, and then to sort of segue into current affairs, issues to do with academia, political issues. And I think that, to me, that's what's interesting. We write this in the afterword, don't we? There's sort of this interesting convergence of interests. On the one hand, talking about professional matters and political matters, and then talking about our favourite detective novels, and then sort of starting to feel a bit frustrated with mainstream sociology that it's not necessarily answering to the problems that we were talking about. Yeah.
And Mary and I used to work together on a journal of European Journal of Women's Studies, and Mary and the other author, Kathy, we used to get the business out of the way and then talk about detective fiction.
And I would say, actually, collaboration, if you're going to write about detective stroke crime fiction, is essential because the field is so vast that one person, unless they're some kind of demonic reader, could not possibly cover the field. So one of the really great things about working together is that we all kept on informing each other. Mm. I mean, that was crucial to the project.
Mm. I mean, it is probably interesting as a starting point almost to think a bit about what that object is actually. You know, you mentioned the kind of vastness of the field, but what are we actually talking about when we say detective fiction? Because early on in the book you kind of specify, you know, it's not really just crime, you know, that there's something specific about the genre itself and the object. So it'd be interesting to get a starting point for what this object is.
My view of it is that detection and detecting suggest that you're going to look at the process of how an investigation is taking place. I think once you start to talk about crime fiction, you're dealing with very hard and clear boundaries between what is a crime and what is not a crime. And one of the things that we wanted to do in this book is to actually illuminate the ways in which in the last 50 years, certainly some of those boundaries between what's criminal and what isn't criminal have started to become very, very blurred. So yes, of course, you might end up with a dead body, you might end up with some other kind of act, which is, of course, in legal terms, criminal. But the point is, there's an enormous amount of other behaviour that occurs socially, which you can't easily classify, or you might want to classify it in a number of different ways.
It's really interesting that even in the definition, you've gone straight to a claim about the social, you know, kind of a vision of how the social works. And this, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, this is the kind of strong thesis of the book, that we're not just talking about a kind of sociology of the genre, which, you know, you talk about production processes or who the authors are, this kind of thing, but we're talking about detective fiction as a means of knowing the social. And again, exactly. Sort of touched on that. And it'd be great to hear that thesis laid out, actually, because I think, you know, that is a kind of crucial thing that the book is doing.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head. We are interested in making quite an ambitious grand claim about the possibility, the potential of detective fiction, not just, you know, something that can nicely illustrate a historical period or, you know, sort of take the temperature, socially speaking, but can actually be a form of inquiry in and of itself. And that is really important to us. I mean, when we got to the conclusion, we were quite concerned to set out that thesis. And the term we sort of reached towards was social texture was particularly important. And as a sort of conceptual tool, if you like, or a form of inquiry that is central to the detective novel and could, we would say perhaps should, be more central to sociological work too. So texture is a sort of concept that's much prized within the arts, and it refers to the connection between a work of art's different elements. It's the sort of perceptual depth, if you like, that a work of art creates. And the work of an art critic is therefore to sort of determine the relationship between an artwork's different elements, to kind of move between the particular and the general and work out the overall effect. The literary detective's job is pretty similar. You know, it's to kind of glean the relationship between particular elements of what's going on and then make grander, more general claims, theorising, if you like. And we think sociologists could learn an awful lot from that sort of endeavour. You know, it's a form of endeavour that pays very close attention to relationships, communities, social situations, and then moves out to think about, you know, what the sociogenesis, if you like, of those relationships, communities, and so on.
I mean, the question that sort of arises from that, and, you know, this is very much the conclusion of the book, I see. So what do you think sociology is, not maybe not done, but, you know, where is this kind of gap in contemporary sociology that detective fiction as a practice would fill?
Well, I suppose, and I don't know if Sarah would agree with this, but I think one of the long-term problems in sociology is the individual. How do you demonstrate? You have a thesis about what is happening in a particular society, a particular culture, in which you can demonstrate A to Z of that behaviour or its characteristics. How does that actually get into an individual behaviour? It's that intersection, it's that connection which we wanted to explore. And I think one of the ways in which I would illustrate this by is referring to the characters of many of the detectives of 1970s detective fiction, in which they cross all kinds of boundaries. You know, they are in many ways damaged people, as we might describe them. They do all sorts of things which are supposed to be illegal, maybe immoral, and so on and so forth. But at the same time, they are working towards something which, in moral terms, they recognise as good and legitimate. And it's that kind of working through these kinds of moral questions which I think is interesting, because that makes some of these connections between the individual and society, I think, most apparent, but also actually illustrates how sometimes those lines are actually blurred as well. So at the same time as you're joining up dots, you're also saying that sometimes those dots can't be joined up. You're dealing with two kinds of connections, and I think that that's what's so interesting and so important.
I think that's right, and I think the other thing that I would say that in terms of what sociology could learn, the gap, as you put it, with mainstream sociology, what contemporary detective fiction does particularly well, is the latter does a particularly good job, of course it does because it's fiction, of conjuring up the social world and populating the social world. And, you know, without wishing to suggest there's absolutely zero merit in contemporary social theory, I wouldn't want to, of course, because I'm going to get lots of hate mail for that. So not at all.
P45.
I know, exactly. Not at all. But I do sometimes feel like when you read contemporary mainstream social theory, particularly that's particularly popular today, so Bauman and Foucault and Baudrillard, and I'm really putting my neck on the line here, Bourdieu, you know, these are pretty unpeopled accounts. Like sometimes reading these accounts of the social world, and they are accounts of the social world at the end of the day, it feels a bit like walking through a ghost ship, you know, in the sense that there's not much work done to really sort of conjure up the social. And that's a source of frustration for me. I think that's something that sociology should have a commitment to doing. And it's something that detective fiction does particularly well, of course.
I mean, a really obvious way to illustrate this is with a question about social change.
Mm.
And you do that, you know, sort of really well quite early in the book by thinking through, I guess, you know, you might think of them as kind of giants of the genre, Agatha Christie on the one hand, and then Steve Larson, you know, who, I mean, in some ways, it's incredible they're even the same genre, because they're so, so different.
Mm.
But there is the kind of sense you draw out of here is change in technology, the nature of modernity, globalisation, illustrated by thinking about these two authors.
Mm. I mean, I think also what you have to say is actually not to think of those two canonical figures, Larson and Christie, as separate, but actually see the connections. Because in a way, what Christie does is her two central characters are in themselves outsiders. I mean, single elderly women are outsiders. They always have been. I mean, you know, Miss Marple isn't actually identified as a witch, but she might well, in previous periods, been identified as precisely that. She doesn't have a cat, but if she had a cat, I mean, you could push that connection even further. Exactly the same as Blomqvist and Salander in the Millennium Trilogy. They're outsiders. So you're dealing with people in the same sort of situation, it seems to me, even though how they do that outsiderness has, of course, changed.
That's really, really interesting. I guess the sort of things that we see the continuities through there are what we might think of as, you know, they're kind of, they're doing of themselves.
Mm.
But obviously the context is...
The context is very different. Mm. But I noticed that, I mean, in the recent, if I might speak about something which is not a novel, but in the recent dramatisation of Christie's The ABC Murders, you know, what was given to Poirot was an identification with actually an immigrant situation. Somebody who was a refugee, somebody who came to this country fleeing from war, fleeing from slaughter. And you think, okay, Christie was well aware of that. That's what she was doing. And it's those kinds of hidden depths, which, of course, that television dramatisation made clear. And I think you have to recognise, because sometimes that isn't recognised in Christie. There's so much, you know, sunny 1920s period drama, and that obscures the places, the imagined places, which Christie is situating her characters in.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I mean, you deal with really, I guess, kind of grand sociological theoretical themes throughout the book, and one of those is this idea about kind of blame responsibility. And one of the texts, I mean, I haven't read this, so it might be interesting from, you know, my point of view to hear a bit more. But one of the texts you talk about is Calling Out for You, which sort of, at least in my understanding, is concerned with working out who is to blame for things in the world, which obviously is a major kind of contemporary concern, slightly different from who or what is responsible.
Yes. Yeah, Calling Out for You is a 2006 novel written by Norwegian crime writer Karen Fossum. And Fossum's really interesting, I think. You know, her sort of central concern throughout her work is this question of what happens to small communities when violence erupts, and, you know, how violence might go underground and how we sort that out. And Calling Out for You is no different to the rest of her oeuvre, if you like. Its central character is this very sort of modest, middle-aged man, Gunter Yeoman, living in a remote Norwegian community. And we start the book by following him as he, you know, clears out his life to make room for his new bride, who he met whilst travelling in India, this sort of lovely, vibrant woman called Poona that we learn about. And she's moving over to Norway to join him. So the first few pages of the novel sort of really lovely account of this guy who's making space for somebody new. But Poona never makes it. So her corpse is found several days after she's due, very unceremoniously dumped in a nearby field. And we get to that point very soon. And that's what's really important. You know, we get to the body within 20 pages of the novel. And the novel is about what happens afterwards. And it's not about clearing up what happened, which is important and interesting. You know, what follows is a really nuanced account of a community coming to terms with what's happened, coming to terms with its own bigotry and xenophobia, suspecting one another, suspecting everyone, keeping secrets from one another, noticing, telling details, doing that sort of collective work of detection. And we end the novel with something really curious, but also characteristic of post-1970s detective fiction, we want to say. We end with a lack of resolution. So someone's collared for the crime, arrested, but there's a great sense of dissatisfaction concerning, well, is this really the person? Wasn't this sort of a convenient person to blame? And it's sort of incredibly anticlimactic in that respect. And it's noticeable the amount of post-1970s detective fiction that does that. Asa Larson's The Savage Altar, which we write about in the book too, is another sort of case in point where, interestingly, we sort of seem to reach the satisfying conclusion of this is the person who did it. And then the author sort of pulls up and says, well, maybe not, though. And that's kind of a really interesting pulling the rug under from under our feet type of moment. So there is a refusal to reach a clear resolution in much post-1970s detective fiction. And there is, and I think this is what's really important, a really central tension between the difficulty of knowing for sure who did this bad thing on the one hand, and then on the other hand, the desire for someone to pay, the desire for heads to roll, the importance of blame, the salience of blame as a sort of social cultural mechanism, if you like. And Calling Out for You is a sort of great example of that, I think. You know, it countenances the possibility that the wrong person's been identified, but going all the way back to, you know, sort of exposition at the start of that novel, it makes it clear that something's been lost, that there's a gap in someone's life, that there is a debt to pay. And it's balancing those two things that Calling Out for You does a particularly good job of, I think.
I mean, slightly differently later on in the book, you pick up this idea about what the good life means and what it means to kind of live well.
Yeah.
But that blame and responsibility dichotomy or tension is through there as well when we think about the housing crisis, when we think about the financial crash, when we think about, you know, kind of broader social questions of the idea of knowing, you know, the banking sector was responsible, but also nobody went to prison, et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, you illustrate that with a couple of novels, and you sort of flag up in the book, I think, is it Broken Harbour, where you say, spoiler alert, because of you know, you sort of have to know who did it to explain that that story. But yeah, it'd be interesting to hear about that kind of sense of how we've seen the good life and what it is to live well. In some ways, kind of, I guess, not delivered, and how detective fiction grapples with that.
I think detective fiction has actually grappled with it for quite a long time, because Christie's got quite a lot of women in her fiction who are, as she sees it, tempted by what is the emergence of a consumer society, of, you know, living up to certain kinds of standards of feminine beauty. That's there. But in Broken Harbour, it's so much more, because there are entire sectors of the economy which are devoted to selling people and convincing people of the achievability of a form of material life which is going to guarantee and bring with it personal personal and emotional satisfaction. I think that that's what's crucial. It's not just about saying, this is a nice house, come and live in it. It's about saying, come and live in this house, and you will be happy, your children will be stable and well-adjusted, and you and your husband, and it's very heterosexual, will have a wonderful, wonderful relationship. I mean, the thing about blame in this context is precisely, I think, made at the end of the film The Big Short, because they bring up the statistics of the numbers of Americans or citizens of the United States who lose their houses, lose their jobs, and then there's actually one man who goes to prison. There's no accountability. You know, the blame is in the system, but how do you actually make a system accountable for this misery that has actually been produced? And I think that actually that's what precisely what Tana French is writing about. How do you actually say, look, the people who sell these rubbish houses and these rubbish places are actually doing something which on the face of it, of course, is entirely legal, entirely acceptable, and entirely condoned. But what does it produce? I mean, it doesn't, of course, in many cases, produce the savage destruction of families. But if you don't take that literally, of course, it does produce a lot of other forms of destruction in terms of other kinds of stress, other kinds of anxiety, which those aspirations, I think, could be made accountable for.
I mean, sorry.
No, I was just about to say, yeah, I think that one thing that's interesting, I mean, Broken Harbour's a great example of this, but one thing that's really interesting throughout post-1970s detective fiction is it's almost like you've got, writ large, a truth problem and a blame problem, and that those things sort of overlap. So it's like a moral problem of, well, how do you pin down who's to blame and the importance of doing that and the impossibility of doing that? And you've got an overlapping problem of an epistemological problem of, well, you know, in a post-1970s era with increased scepticism about truth and authority, how do we really know for sure? Who should we trust in terms of sources of authority? And I think, again, that's something that, you know, sociology hasn't necessarily been quick to reach towards, those sort of two really big pressing problems. But again, post-1970s detective fiction has for quite a while been centrally concerned with that, you know, the blame problem and the truth.
Yeah, and I think it's very much concerned with getting to what is true, what is livable.
Mm.
And I think what is livable as a good life? Because in a sense it's trying to say, look, all this stuff that you are given that is dangled before you, leaving the EU is just another example, I suppose. You might want to believe it, but is it actually going to be true? You know, it is a problem, which I think, you know, recent politics, the politics of the last 3 years, have actually demonstrated very clearly. I mean, I don't think, as far as I know, detective fiction has not yet engaged with the politics of Trump and the EU vote. But that seems to me very much where it was going in these novels.
Mm. I mean, it's funny as well, because the sort of mode of doing this inquiry comes with, you know, you can talk in cliche terms of kind of anti-heroes, outsiders, but many of the kind of key characters are not just, you know, sort of polar opposites in some ways of these, you know, ideas about the good life, but they themselves kind of carry significant baggage, which on the one hand kind of means that their, you know, skepticism towards authority makes sense, so we can, you know, almost kind of identify with it, but also on the other hand makes us think, maybe this isn't the inquirer that we should be, and there are flaws about doing social inquiry. And it'd be good to hear about, you know, the kind of the rather sort of checkered position of the detective, you know, and kind of who these characters are.
They live with so much ambiguity and so much indecision and so much difficulty in terms of reaching the truth. And that's, I think that's what's interesting. It's like a very practical set of problems in terms of how you work out what happened whilst you don't have access to all the information you might desire, whilst your access might be tarnished in certain ways. And I think there's a sort of an ethical element to all of that, like how you proceed when you know that you don't have full access to things that might be approaching the truth, at the same time as recognising that you must reach towards something that approaches the truth. And that's the dilemma of the detective novel, I think. Yes. I mean, the only other thing I'd say at that point as well is to just pick up on what you've observed there, Dave, of the sort of importance of non-professional detectives in post-1970s detective fiction, and the difficulty, if you are a member of the police force, in doing that job of detection well. You know, and I think it's a really sort of pointed, vivid critique of criminal justice that we find often in post-1970s detective fiction.
Yeah, a critique of bureaucracy, of institutions.
Yeah.
And again, you know, you do this sort of earlier in the book, with the sense of, you know, the failure of the social state.
Yes.
Or the success of the social state in producing abhorrent situations,
yes,
you know, that give rise to particularly, you know, not individual criminal acts, but socially distributed harms, which I suppose it is again something that is classically sociological. But it's this question about how do you populate that social failure?
I think there's that, and I think it's also, in populating, how do you capture things like slowness, drudgery, hardness, viscerality? And I think those are really important concerns of the post-1970s detective novel too. So I'm reminded of Missing, Karen, I can't say the surname, that's terrible, Avedon novel. Who's going to have? Are you there?
Forgive that.
Thank you. In the middle of the podcast. But no, that's a brilliant, that's a really great novel about a homeless woman who is kind of framed for a crime. But it's so central to that novel is just the physical experience of having to continually move on and being hated for no good reason often, and feeling really cold and having to live in a shed. And these are things that these novels do incredibly well. So there's things about discomfort, pain, viscerality, the material aspects of the world that are so vivid in the detective novel. I think they're important to that sort of failure of the social state or success of the social state, which I think you see it.
I mean, I totally agree about Missing. I think that creation of the experience of homelessness, I mean, should be reprinted and read by everybody, because I don't think I've ever read anything in the second half of the 20th century which is quite so vivid about it. I mean, she really gets, as Sarah says, the sense of hatred, the sense of dispossession, the sense of just the absolute insecurity of yourself in that situation. I mean, what it means to have nowhere to go, which you can call your own. And I mean, it's so basic, it's so fundamental. Mm. And the sense of having that removed from you, I think, is caught wonderfully in that.
And I think, just to sort of segue back into academic modes of thinking, it's interesting to me that certain, it has to be said, female social philosophers are quite on the money with these sorts of issues. So Bonnie Honig's work on public things and Jane Bennett's work on materiality, really interesting at getting at this sort of, you know, the possibility, the fact, just the sheer fact that we live in a physical material world that, you know, we come up against, and that physical material world is harder for some people than others. And I think sociology needs to catch up with that set of ideas, or engage with it at least.
I mean, the other thing towards sort of second half of the back end of the book is this question of gender. And in some ways, it goes with the grain of, and again, you might correct me, but, you know, a sense of detective fiction engaging with violence much more kind of explicitly, you know, and much more kind of graphic depictions and graphic acts of violence. But also in terms of things like how gender shapes careers within institutions, you know, how gender kind of, you know, allows certain actors to almost do kind of quite well in their careers, almost do, dare I say, quite well out of horrific acts, and others, struggle against particular barriers. And there's a couple of examples you give. But it'd be interesting to hear about sort of take on gender through detective fiction.
Well, I think we've got a strong sense of that is to be explored further. I mean, no doubt about it. No doubt about it. But as far as this book is concerned, I think we were... one thing that I think is quite striking is the forms, and I think anybody who reads any amount of detective fiction notices this immediately, that the majority of victims are female. Mm-hmm. They're also overwhelmingly young and female. That's the, that comes up. I mean, I would not, but I would say statistically you could probably back that up. So that's quite important. So what is going on in terms of violence against that particular kind of person, that particular sort of human being? That is a question which I think needs to be further explored. The other thing about making the people who make careers as detectives in institutions, I think you run up against the usual kinds of things about people in careers, in that those people who are, as it were, carefree, as it's described in the literature, can work 24/7 and other people can't.
Yes.
I mean, that is just very simple, very ongoing, totally foundational to the way that the social world operates.
I mean, could you give me the example of, is it Tota and Breen, which are two kind of key characters?
Yes. Well, they're terrific characters, and I think William Shaw does a fantastically good job of creating both creating a general world, which is the 1960s, but also creating a sense of characters trying to move out of gender stereotypes. That's what's important about William Shaw's work. He's trying to say, okay, how do we make this different? And he's also saying it's very different. It's very difficult.
Mm. I think, yeah, I mean, we're a big fan of William Shaw's work in general, it has to be said. I think as well that, thinking beyond those examples, it's interesting and we think worthy of further consideration and thought. So, in terms of thinking about future projects, this is something that's on our mind an awful lot at the moment. But one thing that's sort of very striking is the way in which detective work in novels specifically remains a very gendered pursuit. So, yeah, you're right, there's sort of interesting examples of detectives sort of resisting and moving out of gender stereotypes. But one thing that's really interesting is the fact that female detectives, where they're successful, tend to be directing their energies towards disentangling the problems of intimate life and violence within intimate relationships. And male detectives more likely to be facing down those sort of big, grand, corrupt institutions, entangled webs of, of networks of criminals and so on and so forth, and be engaged in those more sort of upward-looking professional battles. So there's something really interesting about what detective fiction does with that.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the things that occurs to me is this issue of the way in which many of these young women who are the victims of male violence are imprisoned prior to their death. And you think of the slogan, take back control. And I'm really interested in these homologous relationships between a political discourse about exercising control over a world which you feel has run away from your control and what's going on in detective fiction in which the male, if you like, perpetrators of crime feel it necessary to physically imprison women.
Yeah.
This is different from in the 1920s, 1930s. Women were killed because, for very often very straightforward reasons of sex or money. I mean, the two cliches of detective fiction. And now you think, actually, very often, some of those motives aren't there. There's something simply about this young person, this young female person, is out of control. She's out of my control.
Mm.
And it doesn't really matter who she is, but I've got to exercise my control over that.
I think, yeah, absolutely. You're totally right, Mary, as always. But I think...
He said it's less loud.
I think it's interesting, we sort of talked about how writing this book was a bit of an intellectual journey in many respects, but by the final chapters, for me, I sort of was coming to see this type of detective fiction is just so centrally about the experience of powerlessness and what it means to feel, you know, as though you are subject to the worst excesses of power, what happens to people under those circumstances, and where that sense of powerlessness comes from. So I think absolutely you're right, but I think that's sort of, to me, that's core to the thematic of the post-70s detective novel.
I mean, one thing that's come up as we've been talking that's really kind of come to the forefront, having worked through the book as well as, you know, sort of been discussing it with you today, is do you think there are any kind of any ways sociology could talk back to detective fiction in terms of actually saying, you know, we've noticed that this genre convention around violence, young women, questions of powerlessness and control, maybe you might do that slightly differently. You know, maybe there are consequences of that as a kind of now core part of the genre. Or is that just part of the world that this genre is reflecting? Because, I mean, the strong thesis around sociology learning from detective fiction, do you think we can go the other way as well? Can detective fiction learn from sociologists?
I don't know what Mary's going to say, but my instinct is to say I wouldn't want to put barriers around an artistic form, which has been, you know, amongst the most expressive of artistic forms in my view. So I'd say that as a sort of you know, to preface what I'm just about to say, which is that we are nonetheless keen to talk not just to the sociological world, but to the crime writing world. And that, you know, that's important to us. In terms of, you know, where we direct this thesis, let's put it in sort of softer terms to how you've put it, perhaps. But I certainly think there's room to discuss, if you like, on both sides of the fence.
I think actually I very much agree with that, and I think that that's what we would want to do, and the way that we want to see it. I often think about this in terms of the ways in which the art world has moved away from galleries, in which art has become about process. It's not about the thing on the wall. It's about the art of creating a garden, the art of the everyday. And I know there's been a cultural turn in sociology, so you could say, okay, we've done that. But I also think there's a case for actually saying, okay, well, how do we combine that turn with a recognition of the existing and ongoing power of the structural? So that this isn't just about sort of putting emphasis in one new context. It's about trying to bring together some sense of what is now an increasingly, as it were, pop-up world. And it's popping up, not because suddenly people have decided that that's just a good idea, but it's popping up because certain kinds of expression have become too difficult, too expensive to locate in other places. So it's that kind of movement which I think I would want to actually try to embody in sociology, because it always seems to me to become in many ways much too photographic. And the world, you know, we take the photographs, they're lovely, we want to preserve them, we want to frame them, etc., etc. But it's a moment. And how do we give a recognition to the ongoing, to the prismatic, to the constantly changing? I think it's a difficult question, but that I think is in a sense where some detective fiction is trying to go. And it would be usefully infused into sociological inquiry.
I mean, this sounds like a terrible question to finish with, but does that mean another book? Does it mean, you know, a series of papers? Or, I mean, this might sound flippant, but it's not. But, you know, could you turn your hand to detective fiction?
Well, it would be wonderful to do it. Certainly, it would be wonderful to explore some of the questions about gender that we've talked about, no doubt about that. And that, what's so wonderful about that is we would of course have to read a lot more detective
fiction. And I mean that's a really, you know, a really obvious kind of almost sort of straightforward, this is another book that needs to be written that comes from the book.
Yeah, definitely. But before talking more about that, what I would say is it's not a flippant question to ask if we turn our hand to write detective novels, not at all. I mean, rumour has it that Bertolt Brecht was going to write a series of detective novels, and we've kind of lost, I'll just add this in, we've kind of lost that connection to that really critical strand of German theorising that was specifically interested in the detective and the detective novel, So Walter Benjamin, Brecht, Siegfried Krakauer, all these characters wrote really extensively about detective fiction. Some of them turned their hand to it. So there's a legacy, there's a history there in terms of sociological engagement with detective fiction, detective writing. There is another book.
Yeah, I'm just sitting here thinking about it. I'm thinking, okay, maybe we should have a collective detective, you know. So, I mean, usually there's one strong central figure, but maybe it doesn't have to work like that. Maybe that there is something in which every, you know, a group of people, let us say three people, contribute different views of what is going on. So that detection doesn't come out of the experience of one person, it comes out of a collective. And a collective which isn't framed in the very familiar fashion of, you know, the bright one and the dull one.
Yeah.
You know.
Indeed.
You know, the plotter and the genius.